Welcome to CMDA's Voice of Advocacy podcast. Here's your host, Dr. Brick Lance.
The diagnosis of gender dysphoria has exploded in this past decade, as many of you know. From 2017 to 2021, in the age group of 6 to 17-year-olds, this has gone from 15,000 in 2017 to over 42,000 in 2021. This has skyrocketed as far as the diagnosis, and it's interesting that states that have the most increase is California and Massachusetts. The use of puberty blockers in this age group, 6 to 17, has more than doubled, and the same with the use of hormone therapy, now numbered in the thousands receiving hormone therapy. Now, the good news is there are gender clinics that are being shut down almost weekly now recently. The bad news is we have thousands and thousands of youth that need help detransitioning because they would like to go back to their biological sex. Welcome to the Voice of Advocacy. I'm your host, Dr. Brick Lance, the Vice President of Advocacy and Bioethics here at CMDA, and also leader of the American Academy of Medical Ethics. And I have my co-host today, Nicole Hayes, who's the Director of Federal Public Policy for CMDA. Welcome, Nicole.
Good afternoon. Good to see you all.
And so I would like to introduce our two guests, Dr. Steve Foley and Dr. Susan Ashton Lazaroy. And so for our first question, well, first of all, both of them, let me do a little introduction. Steve is a board-certified OB-GYN. He previously OB hospitalist in Indiana and now lives in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. He graduated from Indiana Wesleyan University, completed medical school and residency at Indiana University in Indianapolis. And like myself, he is actively supporting pregnancy resource centers. And we actually have more in common because we've been married the exact same number of years, 43 years. And we also are both Colson Fellow graduates. Now he's married and has 4 children and 11 grandchildren, again, residing now in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
And Susan has been a general pediatrician since 1996. She'd received her medical degree also from Indiana University School of Medicine and her pediatric residency at Vanderbilt University. She's a member of both the AAP and the ACP. That's the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American College of Pediatrician. She's also a member of the Northern Virginia Pediatric Society and CMDA. She also is a Colson Fellow graduate. And she just completed her teaching practicum, which you have to do for this fellowship, in Transgenderism, Unraveling the Confusion. So both Steve and Susan are very active in education. They educate the church, they educate families, they educate legislators, and other healthcare professionals. So let's start with ladies first. I'd like for you both to answer this question. How do you go about educating these different spheres of influence in our culture, and what are the harms that you educate about to these audiences? Susan?
Thank you, first of all, for inviting me to be on the podcast with you both. I appreciate all the work that y'all are doing to highlight the needs of detransitioners, as well as highlighting the harms of gender-affirming care, so-called gender-affirming care, I should say. That is a euphemism, as we all know. So as you mentioned, when I finished my Colson Center for Christian Worldview Fellowship in 2022, I embarked on teaching small groups at our church about the harms of the gender transition care. Since that time, I continued down that path, and I actually take every opportunity that's afforded me to speak at area churches about a variety of topics surrounding this issue, including how the lies of gender ideology make a mockery of God's intended order and affecting our relationships with in all the directions, both vertically with the Lord, horizontally with all the people around us, with ourselves, as we are teaching children, we in the society, some are teaching children that they could be born in the wrong body and that they're not created beings created by the Lord, but that they can self-create. And then the lie of gender ideology also affects our relationship with the physical world as we co-opt scientific abilities and talents that are God-given to actually mutilate children's and young adults' bodies. So the sin and the lie of gender ideology affects so much in our lives. And that is one thing that I focus on at church when I teach. But then I go into teaching about how the schools and many counselors within the schools or therapists kind of behind the scenes have been captured by this ideology, how kids can be affected by social media, and then how medical societies and gender clinicians have abandoned medical ethics and are not truly giving informed consent and sharing the true risks of social, medical, and surgical transition. I also teach about how we can protect our children from indoctrination. Those are just some of the topics that we cover when I speak at area churches.
Excellent. Steve, how about you?
That was such a great answer. I can't remember the question.
Well, first of all, how do you advocate? What do you do? In other words, what audience do you speak to? And what do you inform them about the harms of, again, quote, gender-affirming care, end quote?
Well, I haven't had the opportunities that Susan has, and it's great. I mean, I too was part of my Colson Fellowship was feeling like this was a need for the opportunity to help a group of people that nobody was helping. So one of the biggest problems, I think, with medical care for detransitioning is that there's no standard of care. I mean, there's no standard of care for obviously gender affirming care, but there's really no information regarding how to care for somebody coming off of these medications and that kind of thing. So I've been working a lot with, and we'll talk about it later probably, the Resilience Health Network, and we've been attempting to gather a group of providers that would be able to help take care of these people, you know, around the country, and coming up with some kind of not standard of care, but at least recommendations, so we have at least a place to start.
That's great, Steve. And thank you, Susan. Good to be here with you both. And Brick, thank you. Susan, as you share that you've been sharing with churches and others, and you're a practicing pediatrician in Virginia and educating and equipping churches on this issue, what has been the response you've received from churches, families, or even other healthcare professionals about this?
People are truly shocked when they learn how pervasive this ideology is and how pervasive it has become, and when they realize that over 12 million children attend school systems that engage in secret social gender transition. These schools refuse to share critical information with parents when a child is struggling with gender dysphoria. As to the response, I've seen families rethink their decision to place their children in public schools. If they're staying in public school, they make a lot more inquiries about what's actually being taught. They are going to teachers and administrators and voicing their concerns. Even healthcare providers are shocked when they learn the actual statistics that now 3% of high school students claim to be transgender and another 2% are considering questioning their gender. And many physicians are shocked when they realize that WPATH, the group that created the so-called guidelines for gender transition care, has actually been exposed as an ideologically motivated group. When physicians learn that WPATH blatantly has suppressed medical research that shows the harm of these treatments, they become a lot more skeptical about what's going on in their medical societies and about what's going on in the U.S. in general. I do teach people about how throughout Western Europe, virtually every country is reversing course on gender transition care for minors and abandoning these practices. And doctors are shocked when they learn that there's a whole body of research that no one's been talking about, and it's all been suppressed by the medical organizations in the United States.
Well, let's talk about the network that Steve mentioned. It's called the Reliance Health Network. Is that correct, Steve?
Yes.
So let me give you a little story. It was over 2 years ago, I was asked to testify in my state, home state of Oregon, about a bill, and it was in a open hearing. And the first two to testify for this bill was the physician at Oregon Health Science University that participated in the gender transition of adolescents and teenagers. And the social worker also who works with her testified. The bill was to allow any person of any age in the state of Oregon to undergo gender transition, again, put that in quotes, gender transition, without any parental notification. So, of course, those two testified for it. The two that testified after them were detransitioners. They were two young ladies in their upper 20s, both testifying that at age 15, that doctor and that social worker transitioned, or at least tried to transition them to men. And it wasn't many years later the mistake that they made, and they're trying to now live as their biological females. So this is a real problem. And unfortunately, many of these young people have difficulty finding access to care that will help them. And you can explain some of the issues. One is, of course, just tapering off the hormones that you've been on for years. Of course, there's the physical appearance as well. But tell us more about the network. What kind of specialties do we need to recruit for this, and how can people get involved?
The network's been going on for now a couple of years. The focus has been to come up with, like I said earlier, guidelines, because there's no evidence-based medicine that can promote this, you know, or guide us in what needs to be done, because nobody has followed, you know, women that have been on high dose testosterone for 10 years and seeing, you know, exactly what all the problems are and exactly how to get off of that. So we've been trying to work together. We have several endocrinologists. Michael Laidlaw is a person from California that's very involved in a lot of this, in the gender transition. He's a pediatric endocrinologist. So we meet every couple of weeks trying to come up with ways that medically we can help guide people. I think probably the biggest issue that we have is trying to find providers. You know, you don't have to be an endocrinologist to help these kids, or, you know, I guess I say kids, but the problem with transitioning is it's usually not in a pediatric age group. It's, you know, they've been on this for X number of years. They're now in their early 20s when they start detransitioning, which makes things even a little more difficult. But, you know, we would be happy. I think anybody that would be willing to take care of these people, these guys, you know, gals and girls that would be willing to do something that may not have absolute medical support, since there isn't any and there won't be any for some period of time, those are the people we're looking for. So family doctors, really internists, pediatricians are certainly welcome, but typically these kids have aged out of pediatric care. I think OBGYNs, I mean, I'm an OBGYN. I certainly feel comfortable with working with women, but these women are now quote unquote men and have been on testosterone for 10 years. So that makes their issues more male-like than, you know, than female-like, you know? And so there's a lot of, you know, difficulty in figuring out what's the best way to take care of these people. There's the permanent things of, say, testosterone on women have permanent changes to their voice. There's the metabolic issues that cause them to have a higher risk of, you know, heart disease and diabetes, just like men that have been on it. You know, for the guys that have been on, put on estrogen, suddenly they're at increased risk for breast cancer, that kind of thing. But they also have prostates that need to be followed up on, because typically, you know, even with mutilation surgery, those are, the prostate's not removed, but, you know, obviously sometimes the testicles can be. So Reliance Health Network, check it out. I mean, we're just more than happy to have anybody that's interested. I've been trying to connect with people from different regions when we have somebody call that needs care. And I've been trying to just touch base with different providers, you know, kind of cold calling, really. It's not the best way to do it. So anybody that's interested can contact this office, the advocacy office. And then if we could have a list of people to refer people to, I think that would be the goal.
Yeah, we'll make sure we create a link in this podcast notes. So obviously, let me repeat, any type of medical doctor, pediatrician, internal medicine, of course, then OB-GYN. And I would imagine you could also use psychiatry and also plastic and general surgery, because the complication rate, I understand, is significantly high if you've gone type surgical transition as well. Susan, anything to add to that while we're on this question?
Yeah, I just think that this is a totally new field of medicine. So I think people feel intimidated to be asked to step forward. And maybe it is intimidating because none of us know very much about this, but that's why we are banding together to create this network of physicians who can discuss cases, meet together. We have a Slack channel that we communicate on. We can reach out and ask questions at any point in time. We're just trying to formulate methods to help all of these patients with their vast needs. And every patient's different, right? So there's a nuance to every patient's needs, every patient's desires. They all need a rigorous, comprehensive assessment of their various needs and goals. And one person may have a goal to come off cross-sex hormones. One person may just have a goal to find a psychiatrist to help them. And as Steve said, we're focusing on the medical, but the underlying foundational problem with this is the mental health. So we do have ways to help people find psychiatrists and psychologists through the various networks that already exist, but they're not part of the Resilience Health Network necessarily. And just a little note, we've been saying Reliance, but it's actually Resilience Health Network. So that's super important.
Sure.
Excellent.
Resilience Health Network. And the website is resiliencehealth.network.
Yeah, we'll make sure we get that correct again in the show notes on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Susan and Steve. You all answered the question I was going to ask next, and that was what type of specialties in healthcare are you looking for? And also, how can someone get connected to that? And what would be the level of commitment for someone wanting to help on this? So certainly we'll get them to the website. And it sounds like you're looking for a variety of healthcare specialties to provide care for detransitioners.
The commitment would just be to see a patient and be willing to help them through this process and work with us. And I think what we're going to find is as we take care of people, we're going to learn and we're going to come up with best practices. But unfortunately, right now, we don't really have that because we just, there aren't enough people that we've ended up treating at this point. It's still very difficult for them to go to providers. That's a big problem. They feel like the medical community has experimented on them, which they have. And so they're not all that willing to go back to the medical community, but we have to be willing to be able to help them through that.
So let me ask you where you would want to be in 3 to 5 years from now. It sounds like you'd like to have some really standardized protocols, if possible, and you want to have this network. Are you foreseeing someone in every state in the United States that can reach out? And obviously, just like if you're volunteering an indigent clinic, which many of our listeners do, you just want some people also just to volunteer to provide their services, I would assume. So yeah, where do you see us in a few years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, we need protocols. And we need to continue to come up with those best practices. You know, we need people that are willing to feed us information so that we can combine that to be able to care for people in the best way, understanding the complications and what needs to be done. And that's going to take time. So as I see the next 3 to 5 years, I think the ROGD or the rapid onset gender dysphoria, is a big issue right now, and certainly a much higher percentage of girls than guys, are involved in that. And, kids that never had any gender issues until they hit their teenage years. And I think you're going to see a lot of those kids realizing that, it didn't solve their mental health problems and caused a lot of other issues. So I think in the next few years, we're going to see that. I think if we had somebody in every state, these people are willing to, travel some, but I think telehealth is kind of difficult because you have to, in order to take care of people, you have to have license in that state. So that makes it a little more difficult, although it would be, an option as well. So getting that network of people that are able to take care of people in every state would be a goal.
Susan, anything to add on that as far as the goals next 5 years?
No, I think that's absolutely correct. We would like to have someone in every state. Granted, our states are pretty huge, so a few people in every state would be really ideal.
Sure.
Yeah. And if people are willing to join us and have a heart for these patients, then we're exploring this new field of medicine together. So we'd appreciate having anyone who is interested on our team. It's going to be challenging work, but it'll be rewarding in the long run. We are really serving the least of these. These patients have been abandoned and harmed by medical providers, and we aim to reverse that.
Yeah, this patient population is a vulnerable population. Our team here at CMDA, we like to care for the vulnerable. That's what we do. Yeah. And this is clearly a very vulnerable population. So let me ask you each a personal question. Susan, you're a member of both the American Academy of Pediatrics as well as the American College of Pediatricians, two different organizations. So can you just tell us a little bit about that and why you're a member of both?
I have remained a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics ever since I first joined as a fellow in 1996. I think it's really important when we see organizations that have gone off the rails as far as this one particular topic has gone. That's how I feel about the AAP. I think it's important to stay involved and try to change organizations from within. I think for me, knowing what the AAP is doing, what their statements are, what their policies are, what they are advocating for is important. So I can actually have a voice within that group of people. And the AAP has done excellent work for years. They have advocated on many levels for taking care of children and helping families flourish. This is one department where I don't agree with them, but I agree with a lot of what they do. And so I think it's important to stay involved on both fronts.
And American College of Pediatricians, they have taken a stance on this gender issue?
We have taken a huge stance, yes. We actually authored, or at least co-authored, the paper that was presented June 2024. I cannot think of the name
of it. Doctors Protecting Children. Yes.
Thank you, Doctors Protecting Children. And there was a big press release, and that website, that paper, that press release, that video went viral. It was viewed over 55 million times.
Wow.
As CMDA, ACPs, and a variety of other organizations took a stance calling on the AAP in particular to reverse what they are doing.
Well, thank you for what you do, Susan. I think that is so important. I think that's a great example for our membership. So, Steve, now, my understanding in the past, I don't know if currently, you've been a member of both ACOG and APLOG. I think most of our listeners know those organizations, but if you want to just chat a little bit about those two organizations and if there's an importance to be a member for both of them.
There's certainly a lot of people that aren't involved in ACOG, and I certainly support them. I have felt it was important to stay involved. You know, ACOG has a wider scope than APLOG. APLOG is primarily focused on pro-life issues. And so, you know, I've been very involved with that, although they have made statements about transgender care as well. But I think it's important to know what ACOG is doing. My term for ACOG is a pro-abortion PAC, a political action committee, and it does do a lot of education. And you're right. I mean, there's a lot of things that they do that very much help women. But when it comes to abortion and when it comes to gender affirming care, they're doing a lot to hurt women. So being involved in that, them to understanding what they're doing, hopefully being able to respond to that in some way and to educate people. I mean, if you're not involved with it, you don't know how off the rails they are. I think that's important as well.
All right. I appreciate both of you again for your work in advocacy. And I would make the assumption, and tell me if I'm wrong, but if you're speaking in churches, it's going to be a little different than if you're speaking in a medical society and such. So do you receive both negative and positive feedback for this work of the Resilience Network?
Well, I haven't actually spoken about Resilience Health Network up to this point, so I can't really say that I've received any negative feedback in that regard. I've certainly talked about the network with a variety of people that I am connected with, and the people that I have mentioned Resilience Health Network to have been very favorable and really understand what we're trying to achieve.
Excellent. That's wonderful here.
I really haven't spoken to any large medical groups to get a feel for that, but I'm sure if your ideology is pro gender affirming care, and that's one of the problems these detransitioners have, is they were allowed to in their own mind change from one sex to the other, but they're not allowed to go back. So that's wrong. They can't do that. And they're very much shunned by that group of people who were, you know, supposedly accepting and loving them into this. And one of the reasons why some of these kids are sucked into this ideology is the acceptance. But if they go back the other way, there's a total turning their back.
Well, we certainly want to make known this Resilience Health Network. So thank you for both of your work. We obviously in the future would like more healthcare professionals providing care for this vulnerable population. We'd like for actually insurance companies to cover some of the treatment that's needed to detransition. Any closing comments for either of you?
I think we have enough ICD-9 codes to treat them for the most part. I mean, as far as insurance coverage, and I think there's a concern about that, but you know, I do think there's a lot that can be covered. So I hate to hear people not getting care because they're afraid of that.
Well, Nicole, thank you for being with me. And Steve and Susan, thank you very much. God bless both of you. And thank you for listening to The Voice of Advocacy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to CMDA's Voice of Advocacy podcast. If you would like to suggest a future guest or share a comment with us, please email us at advocacy@cmda.org. And if you like the podcast, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and share it on your favorite social media platform. This podcast has been a production of Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.